Good afternoon, everyone.
Charles Wolforth here, hometown Alaska. We've got a very serious topic today, but also a really fascinating one. A piece of Alaska history, which we don't often talk about because it's a tough subject, but that shaped our state, the people who live here, and shaped the people we are today. And what I'm talking about is the great epidemics, the great death that swept through Alaska Native people, mostly in the first half of the 20th century. I'm sure you've heard the anecdotes about villages that were wiped out, and one can kind of imagine what that would be like, but just consider a huge proportion of the indigenous population of the entire state of Alaska being killed over a short time period by these epidemics. That had to have a huge effect on those cultures, and that comes down to us today. And it also had a big effect on simply the population dynamics of our state. Well, I've got two guests to talk about this today, and we're going to divide the show in half and just have a straight one-on-one with each of them. In the second half, coming up in half an hour, we're going to be talking to Dr. Tom Nicewander, who has been has studied these issues, the history and the current public health issues of epidemics in Alaska, to give us a scientific and historic sweep. But in the first half, my guest is coming to us from State University of New York, John Smeltzer. He is the author of the book The Great Death, which recently came out, and he's with us on the phone. And John is a Athabascan from the Otna region, who is also a noted scholar and author of a number of books. And we'll hear more about his background. John, welcome to Hometown Alaska. Thank you for being with us.
No, thank you, Charles. Glad to be here.
Well, John has written a number of books, and you can find out about them on his website, which is linked from our website at kska.org. And he can speak with expertise on many subjects. If you have questions for him or for my other guests later on, it's easy to reach us at 550-8433, or if you're outside of the Anchorage area, 1-888-353-5752, and you can send us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org, and of course, call only during the 2 p.m. hour. If you're listening in the evening, we won't be here in the studio. Now, the book that I recently read, which came out just not long ago, I guess in 2009, The Great Death by John Smeltzer, is a novel that tells the story of two young girls whose entire village dies in the epidemic, and then they're forced in descending winter to find their way to adults who can care for them. And it's quite a beautiful story. It's told with great simplicity, which really brings out the power of it. I was very affected, and the book has been recommended by no less than Elie Wiesel, the Nobel laureate, who has written so much about the Holocaust. And many people think of these epidemics as being our own Alaskan Holocaust. John, tell us about how you got into this subject. Where did the material come from for your novel, The Great Death?
Well, thanks for the question. Well, you know, all through the 80s, I was a student at UAF, studying anthropology, archaeology, linguistics, English literature, and I had heard these stories from my grandmother and her older sister, and they had lived through that period. They were both born, you know, a long time ago, around 1910, 1915, and they had lived through it, and they used to tell me the stories. And I didn't know much about it. There's really not much literature about it. Most Alaskans don't even really know what happened. And then I started traveling around Alaska all through the later 80s, the 90s, and I'd ask other elders all over Alaska. And those who had lived through it told me their stories as well. And so it started taking shape of, wow, there's this part of our history that we just don't even know. And most importantly, the repercussions on Alaska Native life, Alaska Native cultures, traditions, languages, was irreversible. In fact, part of the reason it's called The Great Death is it was not just the plague killing so many people, but the great death of the cultures.
Yeah.
So it was really the beginning of what became a downward spiral after that.
Now, as I read the book, one of the things that makes it very powerful is that it's told from the point of view of these girls, and you know, we're used to talking about big events like this in generalizations. This is all very specific, and you very vividly painted a picture of what village life was like and what it was like to see your parents die in front of you. And I'm just interested in how you, did elders tell you about that? The work of your imagination to bring that to life? How did you accomplish that as a writer?
Well, I'd say why the main characters were young was because everyone who survived it, who was old and or who was still alive in the 80s and 90s were already elders. And in fact, I doubt that there's anyone left alive right now who would have survived it. They'd have to be 90 at the youngest. They'd have to be 90, because it ended 1920, 1921. They'd have to be 90, and to have any recollection of it, they probably had to be at least 6, I'd say. So I don't know that there's anyone left 96 years or younger who could possibly have a recollection of it. So all the stories I heard were by elders telling me what it was like when they were young surviving it. So I thought, that's where the story is. It should be told as young people witnessing this. And the novel is kind of a conglomerate of various stories. Some of the incidents were from one elder, another from other elders. A lot of it's universal. Everyone said the same thing over and over again. Only one little part of it's kind of my imagination. Only one.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about how you got into this kind of work, because you're an Alaska native. One could call you a tradition bearer, and you've spent a lot of time with elders. You've written native dictionaries. You've written history. But now you're also working in the academic world. And do you feel like you're kind of a translator, bringing this out to the rest of the world beyond Alaska and sort of the reading public?
I do. I mean, you read one of my books from 2006, The Day That Cries Forever. And in fact, you wrote this wonderful, five-part series in Anchorage Daily News about not only that event, but subsistence in Prince William Sound. And I probably could have written this book as nonfiction, and it certainly would have been useful, there's no doubt about it. But I wanted to reach a large audience, young adults, children, adults, people all over the country, people all over the world. This book is published all over the world. It's published, it's in Australia, it's in the UK, it's in Ireland, it's in America, it's in Canada. It just got in Amsterdam the other day. It's growing all around the world. And I think it's like, what was that movie, the Australian Aboriginal Children, Rabbit Proof Fence. It's a story of real historical events that, because they use children, because they use real stories from real people's lives, it just touches people. You love the characters, you care about characters, you feel for characters. That's what fiction does, and that's why I think I turned it into a novel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, it's been marketed to some extent as a book for juveniles, juvenile fiction, although I certainly read it and I didn't feel like you were talking down to me in any way. In a lot of ways, this is very intense material for children, I would say. How did that decision come to be made? And is that who you're trying to reach primarily? Or who do you think is the ideal reader?
I'd say I never write anything for young adults. I write for everybody. I want everybody to read it. It doesn't matter how old, whether they're very old or very young. But, you know, marketing decisions have to be made, I guess, and that was the marketing decision of publishers. I fought with them a lot. I fought with them even at points where they were removing overly graphic material about death and dying. And I fought tooth and nail to the very end and was able to keep some, but had to give up some. And that's, I hate to say it, that's how stories come into the world sometimes.
Yeah, well, that's the work of a writer, yeah. Well, I'm talking to John Smelter. His book is The Great Death. You can find a link to the book on the KSKA.org website. And if you have questions for John, you can reach us at 550-8433. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, 888-353-5752. And you can contact us by email at hometownalaska@KSKA.org. Now, you alluded briefly to the impact of these epidemics from a cultural point of view. Obviously, from a medical and human point of view, the impact was enormous as well. But how do you think cultures of Native Alaska were affected? And also, I suppose, the white settlement of Alaska was affected by the fact of this horrendous series of epidemics.
Well, I know, I mean, you know, I talk to a lot of elders, dozens and dozens, and, you know, in some way, while the tragedy was happening, while literally 65% of all Alaska Natives died during this period, I think this is roughly 2.5, 3 years, 1918 to about 1921, Alaska being so remote and large and no travel infrastructure back then at all, wasn't even airplanes yet, no roads, no trains, nothing. So it lasted a little bit longer in Alaska, but some, like I said, 65% of all Alaska Natives died during that period. But in some cases, that meant that an entire village, though, an entire village. In some villages, maybe only 50%. But even as these people were laying about dying and very horrible, and I'm sure your epidemiologist is going to talk about the actual symptoms of this disease, and sometimes even missionaries at that time used that. They would actually say, look what you've brought upon yourself. You know, you deserve this. And it was used a lot to claim lands, territories, rights. You know, the Alaska Natives just lost a lot of political power, if you will, during that, because of that.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if how many of our listeners would know that villages are in Alaska are more like tribes are in the lower 48, where a village could have a unique dialect and unique sort of cultural history, which presumably would disappear if the village disappeared.
Well, an example is I'm a shareholder of Otna Native Corporation. Otna has, or had, 4 distinct dialects up until just a few years ago. And my aunt, my sister, my grandmother's sister, was the last speaker of our Western dialect, one of our 4. And so you can imagine the same thing you said. There were probably villages that lost entirely that dialect, of maybe only 1 or 2 survivors were left, and eventually kind of just merged, you know, like we're basically adopted into other groups, learned their dialect. And we lost a lot during that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of your book, I mean, what really I enjoyed about it, I think, was the descriptions of death and dying obviously are really tough to read, but then it's also an adventure story about these girls trying to get, you know, to safety and going through the wilderness. And you've got these descriptions of the Alaska outdoors and the early winter that are pretty vivid. Tell me about your outdoor background. You know, how do you develop that knowledge of how to describe those places?
I spent my entire life in Alaska, entire life. I just left in 2006 to come here to New York, and I hunted, fish, backpack, climbed, swam, everything you could ever do in Alaska, I did as a boy and as an adult. And, you know, like the Alaskans, why we come to Alaska. We love the wilderness. We love the outside. I remember my mother having conniptions at some of the things my brother and I were allowed to do as little kids, climbing mountains and glaciers, bear hunting on our own as little 13-year-olds. And my brother was 11, and we're out bear hunting alone. You know, I've been stalked by wolves, attacked by wolves, attacked by bears. My whole life, that's it. I have all these experiences, and I love to put them into my writing.
I bet that you can really liven up your classes there in upstate New York when you bring up that sort of thing.
I've even been stalked by a polar bear, and they go, wow, really?
Yeah. That's when you... You don't have to fear your coworkers if you've been through that. We have a phone call now from Caroline. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. In the 41 plus years I've been here, I've been so frustrated with the lack of understanding that many people bring to an evaluation of life in Alaska, the rural areas. I've traveled over 30 villages and communities, and my main question has to do with what kind of knowledge is given to the people who are going out to administer programs in the rural areas. I know there was, it's only been within the last decade, I think, that they have been requiring teachers to get cross-cultural education, which in my mind is a basic. But there's so little understanding, and people don't put themselves in a situation where they could feel what this would be like. I had someone make a disparaging comment about rural people, and I said, where are you from? And he said, Philadelphia. And I said, well, if 2/3 of the population died in Philadelphia, don't you think there'd be some resulting problems? And he looked at me with a blank stare. He had no idea, and I'm not sure he believed me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'm so glad you brought it up.
Yeah, go right ahead, John.
if I could just address that, because your example of Philadelphia is perfect. Think about it. In modern-day America, whether it's small town or big cities, we don't even know our neighbors. We don't. Ask yourself, audience, do you know your neighbor? Do you know your neighbor on your left side or right side or across the street or across the hall? And we don't. But these villages, everyone is related to everyone. In fact, many Alaska Natives, like a lot of Native Americans, when they introduce themselves in the community, within the community, they'll say, like, hi, I'm Fred, cousin of so-and-so, grandson of so-and-so. The connection to family and to the community is ultra important. And so all these deaths are gigantically important, and they were felt and deeply affected the people who survived.
One quick question more. Do you think that this history almost genetically impacted, certainly psychically impacted on the people, is part of the reason that there's not more encouragement of our young people to go out of the rural areas in to get the education? My goal is that they bring it back home. And I don't care whether it's small engine repair or what it is, that the educational process not be one of stripping people from their heritage, but enhancing it and sending them back in a profession that can be helpful. But sometimes the villages don't encourage the young people to leave.
Okay, good question, Caroline. Let's get John's answer on that. And
thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, John. What do you think about that question? But
well, I've seen this a lot, and it's got so many angles. Imagine again a small village. Very remote, very isolated. It's that young person's entire universe. And suddenly to pick up and move to, say, Fairbanks or UAA or Princeton or Harvard is a whole different world sometimes. Albeit, this is true. The attrition rate, the number of Alaska Native students historically that go off to college, 50% of them drop out and go home within the first semester. The other 50% on average within the next year. Very rarely, historically, that doesn't mean today, I haven't looked at statistics in a decade, but when I was looking out in the 90s, very few Alaska Natives would complete college, and it has certainly nothing to do with intelligence or desire or hard work. I think it was a lot of cultural isolation, homesickness, insensitivity, all kinds of things. I don't want to put my money on that.
Well, you've been through that yourself, right? I mean, what were the, you obviously made it, you've got a PhD and you're a university professor now. What was it that helped you get through that kind of cultural divide when you were entering education in the at UAF?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I miss Alaska every single minute, every minute. I constantly think about it, and I constantly think about back home. I know folks are out hunting right now, and it's driving me crazy. But it wasn't as hard for me. I didn't grow up in a village, per se. You know, I grew up in small communities. I spent my summers quite often with my uncle in the village, with my grandmother in the village. But I grew up, you know, largely in the Delta, Fort Greeley area, Fairbanks. So a little different for me, for sure.
Yeah. So the other point that was just raised a minute ago is the sort of what we could call, with shorthand, the urban-rural divide. Most rural Alaskans know plenty about the cities because they come to cities to shop and travel and so forth. But a great number of the non-native population of Alaska has really never been to rural Alaska and doesn't know what rural life is like. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how that we fix that. Obviously, through your books, you've made an attempt. Have you thought at all about how we bring those two sides together?
I have, but I don't know how to articulate it. It's something about inclusion and acceptance and understanding. I know a few years ago, I forget the exact organization, but it was something like Professional Women in Human Resource Management. And they had their annual meeting and brought me as the guest speaker, and my speech was about hire more Alaska Natives. Hire them, help them, give them that chance, let's avoid the gatekeeper stereotypes. And I know it's hard, and I would like to see those kind of things change.
Yeah. Well, what kind of reaction have you gotten from this book?
You know, it's very interesting. All the rest of the world loves it. I get great reviews everywhere, but I just noticed in Alaska people aren't noticing it yet. It amazes me. This is, I mean, even the Alaska, the caller and talked about curriculum, high school and stuff. Alaska State high school curriculum still in no way wants to make mention of this part of history. It's just not there. They'll talk about the earthquake and statehood and all kinds of things, but they don't in any way steer students towards this period.
Yeah, yeah. So I was also interested in talking about another book you wrote, which was called The Day That Cries Forever. And as you mentioned, I made great use of it in my book, The Fate of Nature, which came out this year when I was writing about the village of Chiniga and the losses that happened there during the earthquake and the tsunamis. This was a piece of work that John did that was really important. The village of Chiniga was devastated by the earthquake. Again, a large proportion of the population was killed in the tsunami. And people really hadn't talked about it in the 40 years since. It was really too raw and too tough for them to talk about. And finally, the village leaders brought John in to talk to their elders and get those stories down on paper. And sadly, some of those people have already passed on since the book was written. But at least they're just extraordinary stories of survival and grief have been recorded. And I'm interested, John, in how you go about sitting down with somebody who's gone through that kind of trauma and eliciting their story in a way that you can put down in print. It must not be an easy thing to do to ask those questions and to get those elders to open up on such difficult topics.
Yep, Bobby, I'll tell you, some elders were so, it was so hard for them that they would invite me, and when I got there, they wouldn't talk. And I'd come again, and they just weren't ready. And they'd call me again, and I'd come, and they just weren't ready, and I never got their story. They just weren't ready. After 40 years, and people cried a lot. People had to stop all the time, stop the recorders, and I respected that. And that's another good example of how a big tragedy that wiped out a population changed it forever. After Chiniga, after the tsunamis that hit Chiniga, basically it was disbanded. The government didn't allow the Chinigans to go back to their villages. They thought it was too unsafe, and they moved them to Titlick. Some moved to Anchorage, some moved to Seward, some moved to Cordova, some moved out of state entirely. But what that did is that dialect, which is its own dialect, so Chiniga has a slightly different dialect than other neighboring Aleutic villages, and I wrote the dictionary of their language, and it was never the same after that. The cultures, the practice, the language, after that, with so many members lost or moving to different places, they lost a lot of their culture, and they're working hard to reclaim what they can. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, that's the process, I guess, is moving beyond the grief and into the positive of trying to bring back some of these things that give people a lot of sense of meaning in their lives. So, and it sounds like that's part of the work you're doing.
Yeah, I hope so. Everyone should have something to dedicate their life to.
Yes, that's right. Well, I want to thank you. I know you're on the phone, and it's tough to sit on the phone for so long. So, and you've also got students to get back to. I want to thank my guest, John Smeltzer, for being with us today. I recommend his book, The Great Death, which is widely available. And we're going to be back in just a moment with another guest on the same topic, and we'll be welcoming your calls. I'll give you the phone number right after we come back. Thanks so much for being with us, John Smeltzer.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, everybody.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
And we're back. Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Woolforth, and we're talking about the great epidemics that decimated, or I guess the word decimated means reduced by 10%, more than decimated, the native population of Alaska in the first half of the 20th century. And in this half of the show, we're going to be talking to Dr. Tom Nyswander, who is a physician. He's been serving patients at the Alaska Native Medical Center since 1972, and he is the regional dean of the Alaska Whammy Medical School, which is where Alaskans get their medical training. Thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, nice to be here, Charles.
And we have a couple of calls, which we're going to go to after we've had a chance to talk for a minute. If you want to get on the air, the number here is 550-8433. And if you're outside of Anchorage, it's 1-888 1-800-353-5752. Of course, you should only call during the 2 o'clock hour, because in the evening, where it's a rerun and we're not here. The email address here is hometownalaska@ksKA.org. And if you want to learn more, the website, ksKA.org, has some material that Dr. Nieswander has recommended, and some other stuff to learn more. So I guess the first question may be, it seemed awfully obvious, but why did so many people die in such a short time period?
Well, thanks, Charles, and it's a delight to be here. And this is an important part of the history of Alaska Natives that not a lot of people know about. And to begin, I'd like to reference that what I'm using extensively this afternoon from a dear friend, colleague, and mentor, Robert Fortine, who has written the book Chills and Fever that is referenced on the website. And so when my readings and a lot of material is from this very well-researched, highly documented reference text and actually fascinating reading. Robert's material, source material, was early accounts from missionaries and other visitors, including all the way back to Vitus Bering and Dr. Steller, who was the physician on board the Bering expeditions. And so we have really the best historical data that we have. I can tell you that Robert really searched in the libraries all over the world for this material. So let me start this way. We don't understand today what these historical epidemics were like. And for example, if you go back to the 13th century in England and in Europe, what was now Europe, the Black Death, the plague, up to a quarter to one half of the total population of Europe died during that period. And the context in which you have to understand the epidemics up here, the early epidemics, is really subsistence culture. And so the early periods that John just referenced, and even before that, and I'm going to try to feature, if we have time, three different epidemics in the history of Alaska Natives. Remember that this is a subsistence culture, and this is pure subsistence. And if you don't catch it, you don't grow it, you don't collect it, you don't eat. And here, you have to do it when you can do it and not in the wintertime. So,
and if you're sick, you can't do those
things. If you are sick, and that's exactly the point, you can't do this thing. The first one I'm going to feature, actually, is the smallpox epidemic from 1835 to 1840. And I'm going to read a bit from Robert's book. The smallpox epidemic that swept through Alaska from 1835 to 1840 ranks as one of the most significant events in the history of Alaska Native people. From Prince William Island to Norton Sound, the disease devastated the population, leaving in its wake as many as one-third dead and many of the remainders scarred, blind, and otherwise disabled. Beyond the physical harm, however, smallpox left demoralized losses of a different kind. The destruction of family groups, communities, religious faith, and in some, even the way of life. The Alaska Natives were never the same after this catastrophe. And further, he mentions that after the epidemic had exhausted the supply of susceptible individuals within its reach, it sputtered and died probably in 1840. The surviving natives of southern and western Alaska found their world in ruins. Between one quarter and two-thirds of their people had died outright, and many others bore ugly scars on their skins and in their minds. Many of those escaped death were left with the easy prey to secondary infections of the skin, respiratory tract infections especially, tuberculosis were rampant. Starvation was a grave threat to many families, since the loss of hunters precluded the storage of food for the winter. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I think it cripples the entire society.
It cripples the entire society. he goes on to say, if you read some of these historical dominants, they lost faith in their culture, they lost faith in their shamans, and it really, as is featured in John's book, I mean, literally whole tribes and villages were wiped out.
Disappeared.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let me go to a caller who's been waiting quite a while. Yeah. Don, did you have a question or a comment?
Oh, yeah. Thanks a bunch for the great show, Charles. I really appreciate it. And this is an important topic. I mean, John brought up a really good point that we're not learning this. Our students aren't learning this in school, and it's a piece of history that not enough people know about. And if we're that old saying that we're doomed to repeat what we don't learn, you know, is pretty scary to me when you consider that Alaska could be the next stopping ground for a pandemic.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can address that from a public health point of view, Dr. Neiswander. I mean, we have things that they didn't have then. We have doctors and we have medicines. Is it possible for this kind of epidemic to happen in today's world?
Absolutely. And I'll jump forward and give you a quick story. Many people know that we, Ruth and I, work in Africa every year. And in the last 2 months, in the place where we work, they've had a measles epidemic, and we've had eight of our 40 kids in the nursery die of measles.
Oh, my gosh.
And that is, this is 2010. And it just points to the, if you leave down your guard, even though we have health care available, but there's basic kinds of stuff that still has to happen. For example, immunizations. And that's why we've been so particular in our state and in our school district in Anchorage, for example, of having immunizations up to speed before the kids even start kindergarten. You just can't let down your guard. That's what's happened in this epidemic that's now reaching across Central and South Africa. And so they've expected there's been as many as 70,000 cases of measles in Malawi.
Unbelievable. And a disease one doesn't think of is still being
you don't
a killer.
Think of, you don't think it was a killer. It never was. I mean, if we get a chance, I'm going to reference it historically among Alaska Natives, but it's very much real and with us. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call, Don. We have another call, so I want to move on, but I appreciate you checking
thanks.
In with us. Now we're going to talk to Stephen, who's calling from Wasilla. Stephen?
Yes, I actually grew up in Alaska in a isolated area. It's no longer isolated, but anyway, kind of my thing is the suicide among the natives. Traditionally, statistically, suicides are a rich man's disease, and the reason that they feel that that's so is because they don't develop coping skills to deal with their failures. And my experience in the village, one village in particular, where we had 9 funerals in 9 months while I was teaching there, kind of drives this home. There were only 2 natural deaths. And the people, you know, we just got a big grant to study the genetic predisposition and this and that, and I think it's a bunch of garbage. These kids are treated like royalty, particularly the young men, until they reach a point to where that they do something that's so dangerous that it threatens other people in the village, and they're supposedly considered an adult, and they just don't have the coping skills to deal with it. And nobody's really addressing that type of issue. You know, and of course, this is all an outshoot of Max Weber's thing, that when you have massive technological shifts, that the young men lose their societal roles, and therefore they're susceptible to anime, which leads to suicide.
I think that, you know, I'm not sure if I would agree with everything you say, but I've certainly seen and heard a lot of Native people talk about a loss of purpose that comes with technology, and that can be hard on people.
Well, they do have a loss of purpose, but it all goes together, and the people who are out looking at this in particular, here I'll give you an example, and this was brought up in the last half hour about the multiculturalism among the teachers. I grew up among Alaskan Natives, okay? And here's a guy in Fairbanks teaching that, you don't have to teach these kids, they learn intuitively. Now, intuitively means you just kind of look at something and figure it out. But when you get to the village, they want everything hands-on, which is experiential, which is the way every child in the world basically learns, is through experience. But here you've got a guy who's in charge of the multicultural program spouting this nonsense.
Okay. And well, I get you, but I don't want to get too far afield from what we're talking about.
Compare that to. They say, yeah. I can go to Alaska, have my big adventure, and I don't have to teach. I can go ride my snow machine because these kids learn intuitively.
Okay. Well, thanks, Stephen. Let me talk to Dr. Nieswander. I mean, when the suicide issue, I mean, could be characterized as an epidemic.
There's no question about it, Charles. I think that the epidemics that we're facing now in Alaska, and this would come from our Native leadership. They would both say that both the issues of behavioral health issues, one, alcoholism and suicide are, in some cases, very clearly of epidemic proportion. And some of us in public health wish that we, like the old days with infectious disease, like measles, I wish we had an immunization for it. We don't. These are really tough problems that are foremost in the mind of our Native health leadership around the state, with a number of efforts being used to try to change and ameliorate the situation, including the establishment, brand new, of behavioral health aides in each of the villages. I can't tell you how difficult that is, because as a villager, and I've traveled to a lot of villages, I've not lived in a village, but if you're a behavioral health aide from the village, you're dealing with your family and very close friends and probably cousins. So as opposed here in an urban setting where it's really you're one, two or three steps removed from your patients, out there, you're all intertwined. It's the nature of village life. It's very difficult.
I wonder if, coming back to, you know, this topic of the epidemics and the great epidemics, is there something about village life which makes communities more susceptible to an epidemic, whether it be of suicide or of the infectious epidemics, in that people are so closely related, they are spending so much time together, and they're relatively homogenous culturally related, as opposed to a city where, you know, we have a lot of people we never see, so we're not necessarily going to get sick from being around them. I don't know.
It's hard to make that leap from infectious disease, although very interesting, we try to do that sometimes and try to understand epidemics. We use some of the kind of classic epidemiological tools to look at this kind of epidemic. It's really hard to make that link, and I've not seen any place in the literature where they have. I can tell you that with the infectious disease epidemics that we've had, some of the great improvements in health throughout this rural parts of the state we've had immunizations. Probably more important, we've had decent housing and water and sanitation. And we tell people, I tell my engineering friends, they've probably done more to improve the health of Alaska Natives than I have trying to plug holes in the dike as a physician over the years. So,
right.
But in terms of, is there something unique in the nature of the intensity? One thing that we have seen that you won't see elsewhere, I don't believe, but we've had the caller just identified 9 suicides in 9 months. They are closely related, and we've certainly had kind of what we call copycat suicides, that a young person will commit suicide, and sure enough, a month or two later, we'll have another, or even after, soon after that, we'll have another child of the particular same age, and that village also commit suicide. So there is that kind of a link. But I can tell you, these communities, as we know, are absolutely devastated by these kind of events. And it's just the kind of thing when you have really, just like we've had in Huna here over the weekend, with 2 really members of the community that were tragically killed. I mean, that's an absolutely devastating event. It's right. Isolated. We're protected from that so often in Anchorage because it's we read about it in the paper, hear about it in news. Mm-hmm. We don't know them. Believe me, these folks know one another. Yeah. They live with them and work with them. It's very difficult.
Almost like losing a family member.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's a tough topic, but a really important one. And I hope that listeners will take a minute to think about the many ramifications of this. My guest today is Dr. Tom Nieswander. He's been a physician at the Alaska Native Medical Center since 1972. He's regional dean of the Alaska WAMI Medical School, which is where we get our doctors trained from Alaska. And I would just also add, he's a pretty impressive humanitarian who has made an avocation of supporting children who are orphans from AIDS in Africa, and has had a huge impact there. And I'll bet a lot of people listening are aware of that work that he's done with Malawi and all the support that's been sent there. If you want to talk to Dr. Nyswander or just get your comments in, the number here is 550-8433, or from outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. The email here is hometownalaska@kska.org. We touched on it a little bit, and I know you had some other epidemics you wanted to talk about. I always remember reading and being taught that the reason that Native American populations, Alaska Natives, were so susceptible to epidemics is because they'd not been exposed to these pathogens, and so they didn't have a natural resistance and didn't have a immune system that was prepared for them. Is that true throughout these cases?
That's been very true. The first, and I'll give you a couple examples of that, because it's a non-immune population. This is actually from our archives here within the university libraries. Early in 1742, the Russian fur traders were carrying viruses with them as they hunted, traded, and settled in the Aleutian Island chain, spreading disease among the Aleuts. And as a result, by 1800, some 80% of the Aleutian population died. And so this stuff was rampant. They would introduce, there's accounts of coming in, having exposure from whalers, for example, coming up from the lower 48, bringing a virus, and in the next 5 days, 6 or 8 people would die all at once. I mean, it was just absolutely devastating. And it just was. Here in the spring, this is the great sickness of 1900. In the spring, summer, and fall of 1900, a disastrous epidemic of influenza accompanied by measles and smallpox and possibly other diseases struck with unprecedented force among the native people of Western Alaska. Virtually no coastal or local riverine community from Atka to Point Hope was spared with this merciless onslaught, which overall may have caused death of a quarter to a third of the entire native population of those regions. And so it wasn't just influenza, it was a combination of...
And that would have been during the gold rush period.
And that was in the gold rush. It's just starting in the gold rush. And it, but it really dates the Spanish flu, which John really gets to, which is the third epidemic that begins in the lower 48 in the 1918.
This is the big world pandemic that came after World War I.
That's exactly right, Charles. And there were at least 10 million deaths in the United States alone. At its height, the flu killed more than 10,000 people per week in the United States. It spreads to Nome. And the account is fascinating. Unfortunately, despite these precautions, influenza spread throughout the territory and half of Nome's white population fell ill. Walter Shields was the Nome superintendent of education, was one of the first to die. The Alaska native population of Nome was decimated. 176 of the 300 Alaska natives in the region die. Elsewhere, entire native families too sick to feed, their fires froze to death in their homes. Many who were belonged to a makeshift hospital were brought to a makeshift hospital, believed that it was a death house, and so instead of coming to the hospital, they committed suicide. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just it's really hard to imagine.
And what were the symptoms? Was it just like a flu that you might?
What would often happen is that they would have the influenza, which is different from the common flu that we have, and then they would end up with pneumonia, or they die of a meningitis. You're dealing with not the healthiest population in the first place. And so it...
They've been hit by one epidemic after another, and they don't really have medical care.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I'm going to fast forward. You'll be interested in this, and you might not know this, but it features this epidemic from the 1918 really features in the H1N1 epidemic we've in the last couple of years.
That's because, what it was reminding me of.
Well... Our link is this.
And that's what we also commonly call the swine flu.
That's exactly right. And the link is this. The question was this strain, H1N1, related to the 1918 epidemic? How could they find out? Well, one of the ways, since the story occurs in Brevik Mission, they talked to the elders of Brevik Mission. Some of the people from the 1918 epidemic were buried in basically the permafrost, and they had basically frozen DNA samples. And they were an
early form of cryogenics.
That's exactly right. And they talked to some of the elders of Brevik Mission and were allowed to exhume some of the bodies and actually recover the viral strain from the 1918 epidemic.
This is happening just in the last few years?
Yeah, just in the last few years. And that's how what you read nationally about the link to this, the 1918 epidemic is related. And how they relate it was actually because of the work it was done at Brevik Mission.
I think listeners are know all about the swine flu. We all went and got our shots. Yeah. And I think that there's a certain amount of skepticism or people saying, well, they cried wolf. You know, they said this was going to be, it wasn't that bad. Tell it, you know, what's your view on the swine flu pandemic or the novel H1N1? Did the World Health Authorities go too far, or is it just an example that we did things right so we didn't have a disaster?
It's a crapshoot. You try to predict what's going to happen, and what happens in when flu hits pigs or birds, that they need one more mutation to allow them to easily affect humans. And the chances of that happening are fairly good. And that's why the hue and cry of getting people immunized.
Essentially, it's going into these animal hosts, developing into a new disease that our immune systems aren't used to. So we're just like those Alaskan natives.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, Charles. We would be not immune. Just as an aside, it was important in Africa because it wiped out the chicken population in many countries in Africa, which was the principal protein source for many of the rural villages. Mm-hmm. In our own experience here, I remember going out to Utch Arbor on Alaska. I think this is probably 1973 or 1974. And you can go to the cemetery there and see the grave sites, and they line up in 1918. I mean, all of them people died within just a few weeks of them, of each other. Mm-hmm. So as this stuff gets in there, it decimates the population.
So that's what we were afraid of, but maybe it wasn't as bad a virus as was thought, or is it because of a good medical response or maybe
no, I think we were lucky, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a decent medical response, but we didn't have that chance mutation that would have really made it a devastating disease. And you're right. Interestingly, the people who did die from the H1N1 recently were young folks. It wasn't old folks, mm-hmm. because we've all been, I'm speaking as an elder of the tribe, but we've been exposed to enough different kind of viruses that we had some onboard immunity. Right. So young pregnant women, for example, if you look in the United States, the people who died in that epidemic were actually the younger folks because they hadn't had all the viral exposure that we've older people have had.
Their immune systems.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
I have to turn my back on Dr. Nicewander to read an email we have from a listener bringing up the issue of the pandemic influenza response plan. And I'm just going to read to you what he has to say. I don't really know too much about what he's talking about, but I'm sure you do. Our pandemic influenza response plan is seriously flawed. There are a series of assumptions that the plan is based upon that is striking for those who know what is already happening in Alaska. The second assumption is most people who have access to water, food, sanitation, fuel, and nursing and medical care while they are sick will survive. As you know, most of Alaska lacks adequate food, water, sanitation, and fuel, not to mention nursing. I guess most of Alaska in terms of area. Do you have a response to that? I mean,
it turns out that if you look at rural Alaska, we are in so much better shape than they are in many in rural America.
We do. Most villages have a clinic.
They have a clinic, and they have a very nice clinic in the last few years. And to the credit of our senior senator who just passed away, who was able to get funding, some of our clinics are very, very nice. And we have actually health aides in each of the clinics and are well trained. And so access to care is one issue. Water and sanitation in some villages is still a problem. Many, many of them. Do have really now decent facilities, and the housing has been improved over the time. Just to let our engineers off the hook a bit, it's pretty hard to have a sanitation system in permafrost. And so this stuff, the logistics and the engineering for water and sanitation is difficult. It has to, in permafrost country, run above line, being insulated pipes and so forth. So it's not the easiest thing that you would think about. But we do have some, and we certainly have villages with honey buckets and whatnot. Very nicely done study in the last couple of years, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, showed that out of the Bethel region, that if you had water to the houses as opposed to point source watering in a village, like a watering station, if you had water in the house and sanitation, it really did decrease the rate of hospitalizations in the village. It was very nicely done.
And
it does make sense. And it was probably one of the first ones that was, the author of that was Ross Singleton, one of our doctors at the Native Hospital, who is actually in charge of our immunization program. So water and sanitation does make a difference. That's exactly right.
Now, I wanted to, obviously, we've talked about the reduction in population just due to these horrible illnesses, which went on probably from the mid-19th century into the mid-20th century. But then Alaska Native populations, after really going down drastically, have risen and are probably higher than they've ever been now. And I'm interested in, like, when was the last epidemic, and why did the epidemic stop? Was it because everyone had been exposed, or what happened?
Well, we had a new one that I haven't mentioned yet.
All right.
And that was tuberculosis.
Right.
And the reference for this is another book by Robert Fortine, Must We All Die? Alaska's Enduring Struggle with TB, and was published in 2005. And I recommend people read that. When I started at the medical center in 72, incidentally, the old hospital on 3rd and Gamble was built as a tuberculosis hospital. Virtually no family that I ever met and have met did not have someone in that tuberculosis epidemic. They either died or disappeared for a year or two at some sanitarium elsewhere.
What time frame are we talking about now?
And this was just, this is in the last 60, 70 years. Mm-hmm. So tuberculosis devastated this population. And it wasn't until 1952, when the drug isoniazid came out, that there was a mechanism to really control the epidemic. And this one clearly was related. It's a coughing. You spread the bacteria by coughing. And so crowded housing, absolutely, the living conditions in rural Alaska. And remember, this is the time of the Second World War, and things were still pretty marginal out in the villages. And so if I have any patient currently who is 50 years or older and I do a tuberculosis tin skin test on, they will all be positive. Mm-hmm. They were all exposed. So this was a devastating disease. Interestingly, so isoniazid comes out in 1952. Time magazine runs an article and shows all these folks in the sanatoriums dancing in the halls, basically, because they can start shutting down the sanatoriums.
Cured, yeah.
The problem in Alaska is, how are you going to get the darn stuff around the, around the state and get it distributed? And so they really developed or recruited women in the village to actually, and took out basically buckets of isoniazid and got the women in the village to start actually handing out the medication. And this was the forerunner of the community health aid program.
Oh, is that right?
That's the history of the community health aid program.
And apparently it worked.
And it absolutely worked. It absolutely worked. And when we first came up here, there were still a traveling X-ray unit that went out to the villages. And we had a tuberculosis wing at the Alaska Native Medical Center that was able to get shut down, basically.
I mean, the good things do happen. And there's no question that the Native... way of life, there have certainly been losses, but in many ways, I mean, if you talk to an elder, you'll be hard-pressed to find anybody who would go back 50 years.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the gains that have been made are enormous. I guess we only have a couple of minutes left, but I think something that would be on a lot of people's mind is could something like this happen again? And, you know, we've all seen movies where the whole world population is decimated. I mean, what with our modern medicine, what do you think really is our risk for huge diseases?
Well, our most recent example has been HIV/AIDS, and it was a very novel disease. I obviously never heard about it when I was in medical school. It really comes to light in the early 80s. And in a subsistence culture like Africa, like Malawi, where we work, it had the same devastating effect as the stories that I've just read to you here. Mm-hmm. The military and police are down 40% in manpower because the 19 to 35-year-old age group has been wiped out.
Oh.
So the
where you're doing the work.
And that's where we're working with AIDS orphans, absolutely. So I think in those parts of the world where you have the similar situations that they've described in Robert's book, the risk is terrific there. I think that is the risk for us also, as you get novel kinds of illnesses of these, and this was a virus that mutated and actually, you know, was devastating. It's still devastating the world's population. The risk is always there. I mean, I think we escaped. We were lucky with H1N1. And that could have been absolutely devastating. The big thing about H1N1 was that because of our reporting mechanisms now and the way we can communicate with one another by with the internet, we can actually identify this stuff early, mm-hmm. characterize it, and we had vaccines available for it. So that's good. But I think that
it's out there.
We tell our infectious disease colleagues, you know, it's a job security program. They're going to be in the business for a long time.
Well, on that cheerful note, I said, everyone, wash your hands. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Tom Nicewander. It has been fascinating. I've really enjoyed having you with us. My earlier guest was... did I say John Tom Nicewander?
Yeah. No, you said you're fine.
Okay. My earlier guest was John Smeltzer, who's the author of The Great Death, a fascinating novel about the epidemics that hit Alaska early in the 20th century. And you can find out more about his book on our website at kska.org. My name is Charles Woolforth. I want to thank Kristen Spack for doing a great job in the booth again today. And also, I want to thank Greg Wilkinson for the Department of Health and Human Services for helping me set up our guest today. And tune in again next week for Hometown Alaska. Thanks.
Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.